Good afternoon, and welcome. Nice to have you here. What an obedient crowd. I've never seen everybody quiet down so well before a word was even spoken. I'm Rick Barton. I'm a co-director of the Post-Conflict Reconstruction Project here with Karen von Hippel, who's here in the first row. We're very pleased to have you all here today and to have our distinguished guest as well, Ibrahim Gambari, the Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Before introducing him, I'd like to just make a couple of other introductions and thanks. First off, the Undersecretary General is Michael Williams, who's the Director for the Middle East and Asia, who's here as well. And many of you, I think, probably know him or would like to get to know him. And then one of my dear friends, Kolu Doherty, who's a countryman of Mr. Gambari from Nigeria, and he's in charge of the UNHCR office here in Washington as well. Kolu, if you could just give people a subtle wave. a great individual and public servant. We'd like to thank, in particular, Kay King, our vice president, for helping to put this together, and her staff, Jen Costa, Catherine Foreman, also Karen Smith from the United Nations for asking us to host this event today, and Steve Siegel and Azucena Rodriguez from our office, the PCR office, for the work of making this a successful event. I hope some of you have signed up for the PCR brief, which is a twice-a-week reminder of events, jobs, and newspaper stories and accounts from around the world relating to this subject of peace-building, peacemaking, promoting peace, conflict analysis, the work that we do. And I hope that many of you have read Mr. Gambari's piece that we tried to send out to you that was in the Washington Times about improving the UN peace brokering mission. Promoting world peace is an ambitious agenda, one that by its very nature raises expectations. Mr. Undersecretary, I'm sure that today's audience brings its own sense of heightened expectations for the United Nations and for your important work. And we welcome your comments over the coming 20 to 25 minutes. I think you all have the fuller biography and his life story. But we look forward to your comments and to a lively question and answer period until 5 o'clock. Mr. Gambari.
Thank you very much. Let me begin by saying how delighted I am to be invited to speak at the Center for Strategic and International Studies and its Statesman's Forum. Well, it's often said that politicians are those who look only to the next elections, and statesmen are those who look towards situation at the end of a generation. I don't think I belong to either. But I'm glad anyway to be here, because CSIS is known far and wide as one of the preeminent centers of research and policy dialogue on global affairs. It is truly an honor and pleasure to be here, especially with so many friends in attendance, including, of course, Kolu, Ambassador MacDonald, and Peter Schottel, with whom I discovered we were together at Columbia in 1968. And it doesn't look a year older. And I must have been very notorious at Columbia, because he recollected me and my name and my wife's name after so many years. It's also a pleasure to be introduced by Dick Barton. Not only is he a leading thinker and practitioner in the critical field of post-conflict peace building and reconstruction, he's also a distinguished former United Nations colleague who served with distinction as Deputy UN High Commissioner for Refugees. This is my very first visit to Washington since being appointed in July 2005 as the Undersecretary General for Political Affairs and head of the Department of Political Affairs, or known as its acronym DPA. And to recognize how revolutionary it is, there's no third world person who has held this position in the last 60 years of the UN existence. So there's courage on the part of Kofi Annan. Some people say it's because this is his last year in office, so he can afford to to be courageous at this point. Sometimes, of course, DPA, the Department of Political Affairs, is often referred to, with some exaggeration, as the foreign ministry of the United Nations. But in any case, I agree with that concept or not, the Department of Political Affairs is the lead UN department for political analysis, for preventive diplomacy, and for peacemaking. We play a low-profile but strategic role within the UN Secretariat, monitoring global political developments, working to detect crises before they erupt, as well as to spot opportunities for diplomatic interventions which could help prevent or resolve conflict. When we fail, then the job goes on to peacekeeping operations. Now, when we succeed, nobody pays attention. We, however, provide political guidance and support to a large number of UN envoys in the field and are currently managing political missions in the Middle East, in Iraq, in Lebanon, Tajikistan, Somalia, Guinea-Bissau, and Central African Republic, as well as one regional office working on the whole of West Africa. We also support the Secretary General in his efforts, and as I speak today, he is engaged in extending his good offices, which I will explain in a little bit more detail later, to help prevent a situation of dispute between Equatorial Guinea and Gabon from degenerating into open warfare. He's also meeting, I believe, tomorrow with President Papadopoulos of Cyprus, the Greek Cypriots, to see if there is enough room for Kofi Annan to launch his peace plan once again. Because those of you who may be following this closely know that there was the so-called Annan plan to help reunite the island, which was overwhelmingly accepted by the Turkish Cypriots and overwhelmingly rejected by the Greek Cypriots. And so he's going to try again to see if there's room to relaunch some version of the Annan plan. Department of Political Affairs is also the lead UN body for electoral assistance. When I came to work in and around the UN 16 years ago, if you had suggested that the United Nations should be the business of elections and promoting their democracy, you would have been laughed off the stage. Now we are engaged in more than 60 countries to help with electoral assistance, and if we might blow our own trumpet, we conducted 3 elections in 1 year under the most difficult circumstances in Iraq, January, October, and December of last year. This is a fast-growing and increasingly important area of work, as elections have come to play such a critical role in democratic transition and peace processes all around the world. We have been especially gratified to be able to provide assistance in major elections over the past year in countries such as I mentioned, Iraq, as well as, Afghanistan. And we are now engaged in helping to provide assistance for the elections in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, which are going to be the biggest single international effort to support electoral process in the world, and a project that is going to cost about $500 million. I'm here in Washington today and tomorrow primarily to exchange views with counterparts in the U.S. administration about a broad range of issues on which the U.N. and the United States are working together very closely among them, and especially the Middle Eastern peace process. Nonetheless, I intend to focus my remarks this afternoon on U.N. reform, but not the part that you may have been reading about most in the newspapers. Briefly, as you know, the United Nations is in the midst of a vital, important process of change, probably the most sweeping effort since the founding of the organization 60 years ago. It has been a convulsive and painful period, but out of crisis comes opportunity for renewal. It is in that spirit that Secretary General Kofi Annan has put forth a comprehensive program for retooling our organization to meet the threats and challenges of today and tomorrow. The fate of most of the big-ticket proposals will be determined in the days ahead. For example, a new and improved Human Rights Council to replace the discredited Human Rights Commission, a peace-building commission to ensure that the international community stays the course in providing needed aid to countries recovering from conflict. Because we have seen that in the past, when we have not stayed the course, I was in another capacity, ambassador of my country in the Security Council, in 1994, when we went into Haiti. We went in with the big peacekeeping operations, came out, hurriedly and left. 10 years later, we are back and costing at least five or six times more what it costs us to have intervened the 10 years earlier. And we don't want a repetition of that anywhere in the world. Then there's the management reform to increase transparency, efficiency, and accountability throughout the UN. The Secretary General will be revealing a new package of proposals this week. Furthermore, important steps are also being undertaken to confront the problems of misconduct that have tainted our vitally important peacekeeping operations. Now, all these are generally well known, and they are in the news. What is less well known and not in the news is what I would like to refer to as the UN peacemaking capacity, where efforts are underway to better equip our organization to act as an impartial third party in brokering peace settlement around the globe, and more generally in providing good offices over a broad range of situations where it can help to diffuse or to contain tensions. These efforts are taking place largely under the radar of the public debate, but with deadly armed conflicts festering in many corners of the globe, they are potentially no less important. Incidentally, what do we mean by good offices? It's not to have a nice corner office facing Park Avenue in New York or elsewhere, but it's about the use of the Secretary General's authority and the legitimacy that the UN provide to try to intervene in conflict or a situation of tension or dispute before they get out of hand, or conflict, low-level violence, to try to prevent it from becoming even more deadly. So making UN good offices better can be a cost-effective way to help save lives and to stabilize conflict-ridden regions in the world. Give you an example. The budget of my sister department, and I'm not speaking about them out of envy, although there are reason to be envious, the budget of the Department of Peacekeeping Operations is $5 billion a year. The budget for my department is $30 million a year. And if you add all the political, special political missions, the cost of that is under $250 million. So what can be more cost-effective than that? Because it's only those conflicts that we fail to prevent that goes now to peacekeeping operation where the cost is truly escalating. And not only may I add, where conflicts are already broken out, we still need peacemaking and good offices. Diplomatic good offices have a role to play all along the conflict spectrum. That is, before the political disputes erupt into violence, during the fighting, if we cannot prevent that, and during peacekeeping operations themselves, and also during the phase of post-conflict peace building. So why has there been so little talk about this aspect? One reason I will venture is that, unlike some of the other critical areas of UN reform, UN peacemaking is not generally seen as damaged or in need of repair, unlike, say, the Human Rights Commission, unlike some of the problems being encountered by peacekeeping operations. Peacemaking is not regarded as one that is in need of emergency repair. Despite the widely noted UN failures in Rwanda and Bosnia, the 1990s began a largely successful decade of peacemaking by the United Nations. Liberated by the end of the Cold War, many more conflicts ended through negotiations than ever before. The UN, in this regard, played an important third-party role in many cases, for example, in Namibia, in Sierra Leone, in El Salvador, Guatemala, Cambodia, Mozambique, Tajikistan, Bougainville, and East Timor. And recent research confirms this trend. The Human Security Report, a major academic study of armed conflict released late last year, found a dramatic 40% drop in armed conflicts since 1992. This is attributable in part to an increased UN prevention, peacekeeping, and peace-building activities. This same report on conflict warned against complacence. Too many conflicts continue to kill around the world, and little known. For example, in northern Uganda, over 1.4 million people are internally displaced. These conflicts have been going on for 20 years, and it has escaped global attention. And for all of the successful examples in which the UN has played a part, there are also a number of cases where even the most exhaustive diplomatic efforts have yet to bear the desired result. For example, Cyprus, in which, incidentally, we have had a peacekeeping operation since 1964, and we are not closer to resolving that conflict now as the UN was. But then perhaps some things are moving, and if the conflict is not yet ripe for resolution, efforts are being made to ripen it. And that is also part of the work of good offices and mediation, is not only to wait until the situation arrives for resolution, but to try to ripen the conflict. And, of course, Western Sahara, for those who are following that closely, is staring us in the face. James Baker, the former Secretary of State, I think spent 7 years trying to resolve that conflict, and I think he threw up his arms in frustration that, and if James Baker will give up on anything, then you know that situation is serious. Through the frustrations as well as the accomplishment, what seems inevitable is that the United Nations will continue to be called on to play this kind of honest broker role in resolving conflict. Even in an increasingly crowded field in which regional organizations, governments, NGOs, and a number of prominent individuals are getting involved, the UN will remain an important player in global peacemaking. The question is whether we will remain up to the task. The 2004 report of the Secretary General's High-Level Panel on Threats, Challenges, and Change was the first to point to the need for enhancements. It noted skyrocketing demand for UN good offices, but found there is only minimum capacity in the organization to support this. So we have been fortunate, in a sense, to have done as well as we have, absent any systemic attempt to professionalize our mediation functions or any strong support system for the envoys that we deploy in the field from time to time, with all variants being titles for their activities. The 2005 World Summit, however, picked up on this observation and moved the discussion forward. The final outcome document, approved by the world leaders, specifically endorsed efforts to enhance the Secretary General's capacity for good offices and also for enhanced mediation effort on the part of the United Nations as a whole in preventing and resolving conflict. With the political and financial support of member states since the summit, we are now working on several fronts to institute tangible improvements in UN peacemaking capacity. First, through the general strengthening of the Department of Political Affairs, which I'm honored to head, so that it can more adequately support peacemaking initiatives. We need more and better regional expertise as well as greater mobility. We need to get officials away from their desks in New York and out in the field so that they can expand their contacts, take the pulse more frequently, and deepen their understanding of the complex dynamics of conflict. And I can speak on this with experience. I was hired by Mr. Kofi Annan more than 6 years ago as a special advisor on Africa, but devoted to dealing with Angola, operating from New York. You might ask, why am I special representative or advisor on dealing with Angola from New York? That's because there are four other special representatives of the Secretary General before me in Angola whose fate were less than positive, to put it mildly. One of them left actually in disgrace. The second one was killed in mysterious circumstances. We still don't know how it happened. The third was declared persona non grata. And so I wasn't anxious to go to the field in order to join the long list of distinguished failures. But in the end, the Secretary General said, no, the time has come. You can't sit in New York and help the Angolans. And so he dispatched me to to Angola, in which I managed to work with the Angolans to bring that war to an end. So the experience in the field is very valuable. Of course, I was lucky because I got help from the Almighty, because Savimbi, who has been the major obstacle to peace, was killed. And so it facilitated a quick, I'm not recommending this as a peacemaker, but I certainly benefited from that event. We are currently stretched amazingly thin, however, at headquarters, with fewer desk officers than even one well-known NGO, whose name I will not mention. We are currently trying to support nearly 36 good offices or efforts around the world. We have recently received some modest budgetary increases, but we need to continue along that trend for a number of years to be able to effectively respond to peacemaking and preventive opportunities. Second, and I thought this would be of interest, and I hope that we can discuss this some more, through the creation of a professional mediation support unit serving United Nations envoys in the field, as well as others engaged in conflict mediation. We want the Department of Political Affairs to be the focal point for mediation in the entire UN system. And we're establishing a mediation support unit in the Department of Political Affairs as a focal point in the department in support of the mediation that we are pursuing. And we have recently been granted seeding funding for such a unit, and we're appealing to donors for additional support. Staffing will begin shortly, and we expect the unit to be up and running by mid-year. The mediation support unit will fill an important gap at the United Nations. It will also serve as a repository of lessons learned on peacemaking, which is particularly important as so many tough issues arise repeatedly in peace negotiation. The new unit will also carry out training for envoys and maintain a roster of suitable candidates, including more women. And I say this because as I speak now, I think there's only one woman special representative of the Secretary General in any of our field mission, Caroline McCaskey, who is whose mission is about to end in Burundi. And they are vastly underrepresented in the field. It will also be served by people with real-world experience in conflict mediation who can provide envoys with advice on tactics and substantive issues or connect with resources within and outside the UN system. Because right now what happens, sadly, is that we appoint special envoys. They come to meet with the Secretary General and to me for half an hour each and say, well, good luck and to you in your assignment. And with no real past experience that are relevant, analysis of the issue, and people that will be their counterpoint at UN headquarters, and we think we have to take mediation more seriously and by being more professional the way we do it. And also, if we have that, we will avoid the situation whereby when we appoint special envoy right now, they bring their own staff. And when they leave, they take away their staff. So we lose the benefit even of the experience of that mediator. And there's a third value, which is that if we now have our own pool of mediators, true and tested, tried and true, if somehow their efforts are no longer yielding the right result, we can fire them. But imagine if you have Jim Baker or Axworthy, the former minister in Canada, when their appointments are no longer, when they are counterproductive, it's not easy to fire them because, in a sense, they kind of volunteer their services. So it's not, in our view, not enough to appoint a well-regarded person and wish them the best of luck. We need to be constantly improving our base of knowledge. Without in any way undervaluing the political skills required, we need to move in the direction of professionalizing our mediation efforts in peace process in the same way that mediation is taken to be a professional endeavor in other areas. A third initiative soon to be launched is a specialized website on peacemaking designed for UN envoys and the broader peacemaking community. The site, www.peacemaker.org, will contain a comprehensive, indexed, and annotated collection of every modern peace agreement. It will also include an online forum for envoys and their staff to interact, to exchange experiences with one another, as well as with mediation experts outside of the United Nations. A little technology, in our view, can go a long way. With a laptop and satellite phone, an envoy meeting with insurgents in some jungle will be only a mouse click away from a wealth of information that can help to further his or her discussions. These are, of course, few and modest steps, but I believe important ones to gradually build our capacity. Taken together, they should help ensure that we have the right people, the right knowledge, and the right resources to do the job. UN envoys consulted in the development of these proposals have been enthusiastically supportive. Of course, preparedness alone will not bring peace to the world. Even the most skilled envoys with the best team and the best knowledge will never succeed if conditions on the ground are not conducive to peace. In other words, as long as parties continue, they are not exhausted, and continue to believe in military victory, no matter what you do, you are not likely to succeed. So many factors affect the prospect for peace. Talks will lead nowhere in the absence of political will by the warring parties. If we go back to some of the cases mentioned earlier, such as Cyprus and Western Sahara, past disappointments can hardly be laid on the doorsteps of the envoys alone. Fortune can be as powerful a factor as any. As I learned personally when serving as UN Peace Envoy to Angola, as the country's conflict finally came to a close in 2002. As hard as many of us were working to try and persuade the parties to end the conflict, the decisive factor in propelling Angola towards peace was not really diplomacy. I mentioned it was the unexpected death of Joseph Savimbi. But I must also mention that at the time when I was pleading with the MPLA government that there can be no military solution to the conflict in Angola, which I believed in, I recall one of the times I came out and I met a distinguished American who I will not name, who said, "Gambari, please give war a chance in Angola." And I said, "Well, we've been giving war a chance for 40 years. But in the end, it really, on that occasion, was a military solution that worked, and the death of Savimbi that paved the way. And since his death and since the surrender of UNITA, not a single shot has been fired in violation of the ceasefire that was agreed upon after the death of Savimbi in 2002. Finally, I believe that enhanced UN capacity will have little impact in isolation. As we seek to bolster our own capabilities, we need to also forge closer ties with others working in peacemaking internationally and related research, governments, regional and non-governmental organizations, and think tanks. We are already relying increasingly on regional and sub-regional organizations as leading partners in peacemaking and conflict prevention efforts in Africa, Asia, Europe, and the Americas. Darfur, for example, where we is very much in the news, the UN is by no means the leading actor, at least in the peacemaking process. It is the African Union that have deployed troops on the ground. They are exhausted, they are tired, they are starved of funds and logistics support, but they are the only ones there, the only ones that have boots on the ground. And where they have been success in terms of preventing greater abuse. The problem is there are not enough of them to make a major difference. Secondly, on the political track, the peacemaking track, again, is the African Union that is in the lead with Dr. Ahmed Salim Salim, who is leading the effort as a facilitator for the peace process. But we are there as the UN, giving him technical support, giving him advice, giving him encouragement. We could do more, but we are there in a supporting role. So we don't have to be the leading actor in every peacemaking effort. The UN can be what I call supporting actor in a leading role, using what we have, which is the legitimacy of the UN as instrument. In any case, I believe that any successful UN peacemaking efforts in the future, either directly or in support of other third parties, will also have to enjoy the active support of the key states at the regional and global levels, many of whom have contributed to previous efforts, either from the Security Council or through a group of friends and contact groups in support of the peace process. Let me conclude, Mr. Chairman, by connecting our efforts to strengthen UN peacemaking capacity to a broader ideal. It's very clear to me that by sharpening our tools for diplomacy in this way, by giving ourselves a better chance to succeed, I believe we are, in a larger sense, helping to reinforce the very case for diplomacy as a means to prevent and resolving conflict. In any case, diplomacy, peacemaking, is cheaper by far than actually going to war or resolving war through military conflict through military means, or even by peacekeeping, which I've mentioned to you. In the Democratic Republic of Congo alone, the UN is spending, you will not believe this, $1 billion a year to maintain the peacekeeping operation there. $1 billion a year. And I've already given you, by way of perspective, the entire budget of the Department of Peacekeeping Operation, $30 million, and even for all the 26 political missions all over the world, that is just under $250 million. We should never also lose sight of the political nature of most of the conflicts that we face in the end, most of this conflict will have to be settled through some kind of political process involving negotiations and compromise. Impartial outsiders will be needed to help build trust between adversaries and to encourage them to prefer peace to war. I also want to go back again to the case of Darfur, which I know is on many people's mind here in Washington and at the United Nations. Without a political settlement, there will be no lasting end to the bloodshed there. So even as we move aggressively to save lives today through the deployment of a more robust peacekeeping force, we should not lose sight of the political process. The point I'm making is the argument or the debate now is about replacing the African peacekeeping force with a more robust UN one, even calling NATO to fill in the gap in terms of when the UN force may be phased in to take over from the Africans, which we know would take not less, with the best of intention, not less than between 6 to 9 months. But all of that are very important, and I support it. And the UN is planning aggressively to having strategic planning to bring that about. But we must not neglect the political process. And that is why, in this regard, I believe the international community needs to marshal an equivalent effort to press for successful peace negotiations leading to a settlement that addresses the causes, the root causes and consequences of the conflict. The peace talks in Abuja between the rebels and with the government of Sudan is going on too slowly. Too many conflicts and differences within the rebel group and between them, and they are taking far too long. Although recently there has been some progress in the wealth-sharing track than in the power-sharing track, but nonetheless, we need to really accelerate that and concert as much effort as we are doing on the peacekeeping as on the and as well as on the peacemaking side. As Secretary General Kofi Annan reminded us last year in his report, and this is what I would like to end with, in his report entitled In Larger Freedom, he reminds us that peace is important, not only for its own sake, but that without peace, there can be no development, and that without sustainable development, there will be no durable peace either. And without respect for human rights and for democracy, society will enjoy neither peace nor development. Let me stop here and take your question. I thank you very much.
We have some microphones that we'll pass around. If you can just wait for it, we'll start right here, and maybe so we'll just alternate so the microphone can be waiting for the next person. If you could keep your questions and comments to the point, that would be great, and introduce yourself as well, please.
Thanks. I'm Lise Howard, Georgetown University, and I'm here with a delegation of graduate students from Georgetown University who are all studying conflict resolution. Thank you so much for your comments today. They were really interesting and fascinating. I have a question about the relationship between DPA and DPKO. There was a conversation a couple of years ago about maybe merging the two. Has that conversation been taken off the table? And how do you relate to the new Peacebuilding Commission? Thanks.
Can I take a few and then?
Why don't we take a few and take three or four questions, and why don't we take one over on this side of the room, this gentleman right here, and then why don't you set up this gentleman over here, Dane Smith.
Hi, thanks for a very interesting talk. I'm from Johns Hopkins University, School of Advanced International Studies at the Rode. You mentioned at some point that the good offices of the UN Secretary General is used sometimes to actually advance the ripeness of a conflict resolution. Could you perhaps give some examples of when that has occurred, when the Secretary General has made a conflict more ripe for resolution? Thanks.
North American University. Foreign Minister Lama Cole in Sudan recently was quoted as saying that Sudan doesn't want international peacekeepers as opposed, I guess, to African peacekeepers. I wonder if you'd comment on the difficulty of moving the Sudanese off of that position or whether that's a real position.
Thank you. David Birnbaum at the Wilson Center. I wonder if you could share with us some of your lessons learned from prior efforts, successful and otherwise, at mediation.
about one more? Do you have enough yet?
Yes, one more.
These are not all going to be yes or no answers.
Sevgi Akarçeşme, CSIS Turkey Project. As for the Cyprus initiative, what is the UN's plan in case Papadopoulos rejects the Annan plan again?
Okay, I think I better pause.
I think that's
here.
A good start.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, these are, of course, extremely tough questions, and that's precisely what makes peacemaking very difficult, because there are really no easy answers, but we have no option but to continue to work at it. The first question is a very delicate one, the relationship between the Department of Political Affairs and DPKO. It has nothing to do with the leadership of the two departments. Like, for example, Mr. Gieno, Jean-Marie, who is the head of DPKO, and myself, we are the best of friends. We meet from time to time. At the level of the assistant secretary generals, they meet from time to time. At the level of desk officers, they meet from time to time. But there's some kind of institutional structure that makes it difficult to have a smooth working relationship. Why do I say that? Because DPKO is an operational department. They deploy troops and soldiers and policemen, and they have planes to move, helicopters, you know, and huge logistics. So they are operational in their behavior. Whereas DPA is more kind of a reflective, you know, long term. We need patience. We have to talk to the parties. We have to ripen conflict. So we're a lot more deliberative, whereas they have to respond to deployment of troops. That is one source of tension. The second, in my view, is the fact that the Department of Peacekeeping Operations also have political affairs officers. And in my view, DPA, all of us from top to bottom, I always say we should be political affairs officers. So you have one set of political affairs officers in the department that is supposed to make peace or prevent conflict, and political affairs officers in the department that is operational. So naturally, there's going to be tension. So because of that recognition of the institutional and structural problem, the Secretary General has decided to do two things. He established, this Secretary General, something called ECPS. You know, UN, we are fond of acronyms. Sometimes I even forget what some of them mean, but but it's Executive Committee on Peace and Security, which is convened by the Department of Peacekeeping and Political Affairs. I am the chairman of that, and we bring DPKO, we bring UNDP, we bring OCHA, all the actors in situation to try to harmonize, at least to have a common understanding of situation in countries, and hopefully a common perspective on how to move forward. The second thing that the Secretary established was a policy committee, which he chairs himself, bringing the key heads of departments, and is the closest to a cabinet that the UN has. And papers are presented, which has to be carefully coordinated and views of everybody put in. And then we argue things out, and he makes his final decision. And it's not always easy. For example, if you bring the Office of High Commissioner for Human Rights, there's always tension between peace and justice. Because sometimes we might recommend that for peace sake, perhaps we should look at how to not to gloss over or to reject the consideration of justice, but to sequence it, to say maybe that should come after. So let's have peace, then you can have a trial of people who are guilty of genocide, violation of international humanitarian law, or war crimes, which can never be amnesized. That maybe should come next. And then you may have even truth and forgiveness commission, whatever it is that they are called in different places. And the High Commissioner for Human Rights said, no, you cannot sequence that way, that if you try to put justice and impunity questions as secondary or back burner, you will neither have justice nor peace in the long term. So there's tension. So we debate it inside the house. Then the UNDP and others say, well, without the consolidation of peace, then without a sustainable development, you will not have durable peace. So there are all kinds of issues that come forward. Right now, there will be some discussion on what to do in East Timor after the current mandate expires. Of course, some people will prefer a more robust interagency presence, like in Sierra Leone, after the exit of the peacekeeping force. And others will argue for a political mission, like the one that we are best at. So all these are argued out in the open, and the Secretary General makes his decision. So I don't see the prospect of merging the two departments, you know. Of course, if it were merged, I would like to head both of them, of course. But I don't think that will go down very well.
You gave us our storyline for the day.
Absolutely.
The press can rush home now.
But definitely. Now, how do they relate to peace-building commission? Peace-building is about putting back societies that have collapsed. So clearly, DPA has an interest. Elections, polls, because elections should be a milestone. So we have a role. We are the focal point for electoral assistance. But it's not just election. What happens after the election to get the results accepted? We've seen in Haiti where you had a result, at least the first result, and we saw what happened. There are so many other cases. So how to persuade parties to accept the results and to move on? How to bring about political institutions to be the judiciary, the parliament, you know, rule of law. So we have a major role to play in peace building, but we are not at the center of peace building support. What are the instances where the Secretary General has ripened a situation? I would say it has to do with Bakassi Peninsula. I don't know, those of you may not be familiar with it. This is an island that is believed to be oil rich, and is a subject of controversy between Nigeria and Cameroon. And both of them went to the International Court of Justice. Now, before the decision, the Secretary General said, well, no, the best thing is to call these people together and see the leaders of both countries and get them committed to accepting the results, the judgment of the International Court of Justice. He did. Well, the judgment came. We know which party is not very reluctant to implement that. But he has remained engaged. He has set up a mixed commission chaired by Mr. Ould Abdallah, whom you may know. He was head of Global Coalition for Africa. As the chairman of the two, continue to ripen the point at which Nigeria will be encouraged to withdraw from Bakassi as demanded by the ICJ, and which is very difficult political pill to swallow by President Obasanjo. Right now, on Cyprus, I think the Secretary General is trying to ripen this because he's met with Papadopoulos again. There's some Turkish initiative on the table. So, you know, it just trying to keep momentum. He has asked me to come to Washington, talk to senior officials here as to what can we do jointly to put pressure on the parties to move towards a negotiated peace. So those are the two that will come to my mind. Maybe there are others. But it's not easy because we are so busy trying to put out the fires that, you know, to create time to ripen. It's even more difficult, but rather than to go to a situation for mediation, which is already ripe, but we do that. Sudan does not welcome international peacekeeping, but it may have no choice. If the Security Council were to decide under Chapter 7, which is mandatory, acting under Chapter 7, which is the Security Council determining that a situation constitutes a threat to international peace and security and decides under Chapter 7 to go in, then it will have no choice. Don't forget, most of the peacekeeping are under Chapter, what some people call Chapter 6.5. That is the in-between Chapter 6, which is Pacific Settlement of Disputes, and Chapter 7, which is Enforcement Action, and peacekeeping 6.5 because it requires the consent of the country. However, it's easier said than done, because Sudan has friends sometimes in the Security Council. And if any one of them decide to veto, then it's a no-go. So we need to persuade the African Union, to say that it is their decision that the UN should take over. And so with African support, it will be easier, I think, to get the Security Council to go in the direction of Chapter 7 and to get Sudan to comply. Successful mediation or examples of failure? Well, I would say, personally, I've only been involved really in one major one, which is Angola, which was a success, but for reasons that are fortuitous, I want to admit. Failure, it has to be in Rwanda. There was a major failure in Rwanda, major failure in Somalia. I think major success in Namibia, major success for the UN in Mozambique. And the opportunities for success are clear. The parties must be exhausted and that must have reached the conclusion that there can be no military solution. Secondly, the population must be tired of war so that neither the government side nor the rebels will be able to recruit troops. Thirdly, money must be frozen that goes into support the war machine. And we saw that UN sanctions in Angola worked. As a matter of fact, after the death of Savimbi, the temporary interim leader of UNITA, Gatto, told me, he said to me, with some exaggeration, but he said, Mr. Gambari, the armed forces of Angola did not defeat UNITA, United Nations Security Council sanctions did. Now, it's an exaggeration, but this is one example where the sanctions work, because at its height, you know, UNITA was controlling 50% of the territory. They had tanks, they had troops, but with the sanctions being tightened, and you remember the issue of the conflict diamonds, less and less money was available. They were reduced more and more to guerrilla fighters. They were chased by the Angolan armed forces until Savimbi was captured and killed, and the rest is now history. So those are the conditions for success, and the conditions for failure would be the opposite, or where the UN or the regional organization refuse to seize the moment. That's where you need accurate information, accurate analysis, and you have to have contact, you have to develop trust. Finally, what would the Greek Cyprus do, Papadopoulos, or what would we do if Papadopoulos rejects the Annan plan again? Now, I wish I know the answer, to be honest with you. But we have not reached that point yet. What we are doing is not necessarily to revive the Annan plan. But we are saying, okay, if you have a plan that is rejected overwhelmingly by one side and accepted overwhelmingly by the other side, how do you proceed? You don't submit the same plan. Okay, you have to now say, all right, what is it that is most objectionable to you, the Greek Cypriots? And that's what we've been trying to get Papadopoulos to do. At least they prioritize your objections so that we begin to address it. And then we also have to appeal to Talat, the Turkish Cypriot, to say, well, you see, you and your people approved this plan overwhelmingly, but it's rejected overwhelmingly by the other side. Perhaps you may have to reluctantly agree to some modification so that we can now have a product that has a good chance of success. So that's where we are now, and we are talking to everybody. We are talking to the Europeans. We are talking to – I've just finished speaking with people in the State Department. I'll be going to Moscow to talk with the Russians. I'll talk to the Greeks in Athens, to the Turkish in Ankara, go to the European Union, because that's also another dimension to the finding a solution to the conflict, to the British, who have an interest. So, and come up with some – after the elections in May, come up with some – evaluation of whether or not is ripe for us to go in. As I mentioned in another meeting, I don't want us to dive into a mediation effort and find that we are diving into an empty pool. So is there enough water for us to dive in order to try to revive the plan?
Let's take one more round of questions here. Can you we reach this person? Anybody else on this side? Okay. Okay, Peter.
Thank you, Don Kraus, Citizens for Global Solutions. You talked about some of the tension between peacemaking and justice in cases. In three of the situations that you mentioned, DRC, Northern Uganda, and Darfur, you have a situation where the International Criminal Court already has some jurisdiction and is functioning in those places. What's the relationship between DPA and the ICC? Particularly, this is a body that's not coming to the executive committee meetings. How does that work?
Okay. Peter Shetley from Brookings. A question is, you're doing amazing things, but you're not getting nearly the public credit you deserve. And my question is, what are you doing with the media to try to get more credit for the achievements you've had in the U.S.?
Thank you very much. There's another one.
Should we, one last question, yep. Judith?
I'm Judith Kaufman. I'm an independent consultant. And first, I want to thank you for your role in getting polio eradication back on track. Mr. Gambari played a crucial role at a crucial time. There have been instances where polio vaccination campaigns, others have gone on even in the midst of war. And I'm interested in what your office and others are looking at as health as an entry point to help bridge gaps and start a peace process or at least a conversation.
Okay. Thank you. The tension between peacemaking and justice. And you are right that we have the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights that is a member of our Executive Committee on Peace and Security and also a member of the Policy Committee. And so it's easier for us in that forum to argue it out. Incidentally, I mustn't give the impression that the High Commissioner is so insensitive about the imperative for peace and she would rather have millions die as long as we can uphold justice. That's not the issue. And I hope I'm not giving that impression. But what she disagrees with is sequencing. In other words, to put the imperative for peace over the demands for justice, because she's convinced that if you don't pursue justice with the same vigor, at the same time, you will end up having neither peace nor justice. And we've seen it in Sierra Leone, where a peace agreement for peace sake was signed, which gave amnesty to these RUF, these terrible people who cut children as limbs, you know. But we can, in a civilized way, say, well, this is our concern, you know. And she will say this is her concern and we'll try to iron it out. I think it's quite clear that the best approach is to pursue peace and justice in parallel rather than sequencing. But in any case, we don't have that much that influence with the ICC because they are completely independent. For example, they've now issued arrest warrants for some of the LRA, this Lord Resistance Army, which I also describe elsewhere as is not an army, it's a ragtag. They are terrorists in a sense. They are not resisting anything because they don't have any political program, and they are certainly not working for the Lord, but more for the devil, because they are truly awful people. Doing awful things. Now the arrest warrants are out. There's a problem because there's now no incentive or little incentive for Kony to surrender. And we are not able to apprehend him. Nobody wants to actually set up troops to go and pick him up. So the ICC has done its thing. We don't know what the impact is on bringing peace or justice. So, and we have no influence. So I guess we just have to continue to do the best we can to pursue the peace track in spite of the decision of the ICC and appeal to Sudan, to appeal to the Museveni, the president, because if you create the situation of discontent among the whole people, they're actually people, then that's you give LRA the excuse to continue to draw people, even sometimes against their will, but still the excuse to draw people to fight and do this awful thing. So we are prepared as peacemakers, and we want to strengthen our capacity in that regard. The second question about the not getting the public credit we deserve, Peter, well, that's what we are in the business of, just doing our best, whether or not we get credit. What I would like to see is that people like you who are gathered here to be our voice and to where it matters to say, if only you give more resources to DPA, voluntary resources, you get results that are much bigger than what you you get bigger returns because it's much cheaper to do. But really, we are not good at UN at all. At blowing our own trumpet. As a matter of fact, the Secretary General always said that when he succeeds in a mission, the member states takes credit. If he fails, they blame him. And so he said, we call him SG, which is our acronym, Secretary General. I said, what SG really means is not Secretary General, but scapegoat. but he accepts that. He accepts that is part of, it comes with the territory, that member states, countries would like to take credit when things go wrong and to have somebody to blame when it goes wrong. And you saw Brutus Ghali, he was set up to take the blame for the U.S., the tragedy in Somalia. He refused. And you know the rest of the story. Now, although we are doing our best, we have Department of Public Information, and Jared Cutler, who is my colleague here, is doing our best. Is best to help Department of Political Affairs to at least get his message across. We're going to start a newsletter. We're going to start a website. Everything we can do. But we'll just continue to do the best we can and plead for resources from member states and from voluntary contribution. And the chances are getting good. Countries are really saying, well, maybe let's look at DPA again and see how we can strengthen them, particularly for this mediation support unit and mediation efforts that we want to, the direction which we want to go. Finally, Polio, thank you for the kind words. Although I must tell you, when the Secretary General designated me, you won't believe, in my previous capacity, as Special Envoy on Polio Eradication, I didn't think he liked me because it's unusual for a senior official to be sent on a political mission to his own country, because that has complications, could have complications. But he asked me to go to Nigeria, my own country, because nobody else understood why people would be against immunization of children for polio when there's no cure for this disease. But because of all the tension in Nigeria and the how things are misinterpreted, religious sensitivities, that was the case. And he asked me to go and do it, and I was delighted that they listened to me. But they asked me, don't come again soon, to ask us to do what we don't want to do. But I persuaded them, really, it's in the interest of the children, and that if they were wrong, then they have the rest of their lives and their conscience to blame for refusing vaccination to poor children and condemning them to a life of poverty and squalor. How this can be duplicated elsewhere, we don't know. But clearly, we have managed in many conflicts to try to call for a truce or something so as to inoculate children and do the kind of health, provide the health and other services that is needed so that we will at least address some of the needs of the people in the midst of terrible fighting. Thank you.
Thank you.